Well, everything about the program is new except the presenter, who's old and silly. New theme, new, got some new colleagues out there too. And I'll tell you what else is new. We are going to change everything you thought you knew about colonial Australia, because it ain't necessarily so. Let me sketch this out for you. We all know the reason why the Poms chose to colonise this joint. We've been told by generations of historians that the British prisons and hulks were overflowing with miscreants, and a solution had to be found to the crisis, a situation made much worse by America's War of Independence. Well, now a fellow called Alan Frost, almost in a mood of blasphemy and heresy, says this ain't right. He says that Britain's need to get rid of its convicts was not the main reason New South Wales was settled. That was a bit of spin, a cover story. He spent the last 8 years digging up evidence proving that the plan to colonise Australia was long in its evolution and had everything to do with Britain's increasing strategic influence in the region and expanding its economic and trade interests. He's under armed guard in our Melbourne TARDIS, and I should mention that Alan is Emeritus Professor of History at La Trobe University, and all of this is put in his new book called Botany Bay, The Real Story. Alan, welcome to our first program for the year.
Thank you, Philip.
I'm shocked by your revelations. Were you shocked to discover them?
No, but I was shocked to discover how many documents there are that relate not only to the decision to colonise New South Wales, but to the mounting of the First Fleet.
Now, in your book, you directly contradict what we've always been told and what distinguished historians have said about our origins. Was this part of a British conspiracy, the convict argument, a British conspiracy to throw off their Dutch and French rivals?
I wouldn't say that. What I would say is that the British were certainly worried by the French and Dutch activities, and particularly by the political situation in Europe, where the French and Dutch concluded a Treaty of Defensive Alliance at the end of 1785, so that the effect of this was to, in time of war, put all the Dutch bases in the east into the hands of the French, and that would have enabled the French to cut off British shipping.
Owen Rutter, you will recall, believed that much of the talk of convicts and penal settlements was a magnificent piece of bluff.
Yeah. He also said he wasn't sure that there was any other motive. He suspected there might have been, but there was only a hint here and there at some distant thought in the minds. I think one of the things I've been able to do is to show that there were other motives apart from getting rid of the convicts. And the way I've done that is there are two ways. The first is to put myself into the mind of people in the 1780s, the people who planned British affairs. And if you're in London and you looked outwards to the east, then India was of great concern, and protecting the British trade position in India. The other thing I've done is to find many more documents than anybody else has previously used.
Well, let's dwell on that for a minute, because it is extraordinary. You go to the Public Record Office at the National Archives in London. Behold, lo and behold, 2,500 documents, a previously untapped resource.
Well, it is amazing, isn't it? Mind you, there's a good deal of repetition in the documents. For example, the question arose about how heavy the cannon on the supply should be. And first of all, they were going to be 6-pounders, then 4-pounders, and then the decision was for 3-pounders. Now, this little point generated about 20 documents. And the way in which people minuted the documents was to say, in answer to your letter of the 14th of October about the guns on the supply. So it's not simply that there are 2,500 new documents, but it is that there's a great deal more information available in those records than has previously been known.
And, of course, because you're looking at archives in London, you're seeing through a different prism than you would if you were studying the historical records in New South Wales.
I'm sure that's true. Perhaps the best way I can put that is to say that the historians who wrote in the past, I think, wrote with an awareness of how things had turned out. That is, they looked backwards from the mid-20th century, let's say, and they saw a mass of convicts in the beginnings of modern Australia. But if I stand or put myself in the position of people in the 1780s in London, the perspective is quite different. I think there's no doubt they were interested in obtaining a naval base that would help them operate in the Pacific and in obtaining naval materials. But because those hopes centred on Norfolk Island and were never realised, from the vantage point of 100 or 200 years afterwards, it looks as though there was no reason except to get rid of the convicts.
But there were an awful lot of those to get rid of, were there not?
There were after the demobilisation, after the American War, that's true. There were tens and tens of thousands of soldiers and sailors returning home. They often got rid of their money very rapidly when they reached port, particularly with prostitutes and drinking, and they were left with no means of living. And they committed crimes, so that the number of convicts who were convicted of felonies for which transportation was the sentence, rose very sharply from 1784 into 1786. That's true, but in my view, that doesn't explain why that explains that the British would have wished to use convicts in the colonisation. It doesn't explain the choice of the site. And to understand that, we have to go to other motives.
I'm talking to Alan Frost. Alan is Emeritus Professor of History at La Trobe, the author of Botany Bay, The Real Story. And this is LNL. One of the people who got this at least partly right was my old sparring partner, Geoffrey Blainey, I understand, in that he didn't miss the imperial dimension to the settlement decision.
That's right. And indeed, I was trained in English literature, and when I reached La Trobe, because I'd read 18th century geography books that gave extracts of Cook's voyages and very often emphasised the potential of obtaining naval materials from the islands of the South Pacific, I became aware of Blainey's work, and I agree with it. What I've done, I think, is to go further in the sense that I broadened the imperial dimension so that it's not simply a matter of obtaining naval materials, but it's also a matter of having bases occupying territory ahead of the French and gaining access to trading routes.
Now, of course, in the 18th century, the likes of Sir George Young were vigorously arguing for the commercial and political advantages of colonising New South Wales, but we've lost that emphasis in telling and retelling the story.
That's right. I think, again, because those intentions were not realised or were not quickly realised, we've come to think that there was no motive apart from getting rid of the convicts.
OK. You note, or let me remind us both, that during the 100th anniversary celebration of Arthur Phillip's landing at Sydney Cove, we were still lamenting its origins. The Bulletin wrote, and I quote, "The natal day of Australia is that which commemorates her shame and degradation and reminds the world most emphatically of the hideous uncleanness from which we sprang." Now, that's a great bit of purple prose, but it's been reiterated and strengthened at every level.
That's right. It's pretty strong stuff, isn't it?
Well, it couldn't get much stronger. Really,
no, that's true. But, you know, one of the things that's operating behind that is mid-19th century religious views of people who didn't wish transportation to continue to the colonies because they saw it as a shameful thing. And so the way in which to prevent it was to overemphasize the degradation of the system. And then the descendants of convicts also didn't wish that their past should be known. And it was only, I think, in the 1950s and really in the 1960s that Australians began to change their attitude about that and to take pride in the fact
yes,
of having
I wish I had miscreant antecedents.
In your industry.
Oh, mine were all very boring and decent. We've also been under that misapprehension that Botany Bay was spearheaded by Lord Sydney, who was in charge of convicts and colonies, but from your reading, it was Prime Minister William Pitt.
That's right. Look, in all the documents I've seen and all the years I've been undertaking this research, I've never seen a single document in Lord Sydney's handwriting that bears on the question of Botany Bay. Almost all the documents that came out of the Home Office were written by, in our terms, the department head, Evan Nepean. And Nepean did the work that should have been Sydney's, but it's clear from what other people said at the time that Sydney was incompetent. And that Nepean was forced to take on the burden. I wish you hadn't said that
he might sue.
And the other thing is that in some of his letters, Nepean makes it clear that he's working according to Pitt's instructions. So it's the Prime Minister who takes over from about 1784, mid-1784 into 1786. It's the Prime Minister who takes responsibility for deciding what to do with the convicts.
But the choice of Botany Bay wasn't made overnight. I was surprised to learn it was first suggested by Joseph Banks in 1779.
That's right. And you could go back further and say that both Banks and Cook, after the Endeavour voyage, recommended the River Thames area in New Zealand as a likely site for a colony. That's not to say that idea was then pursued, but the idea was in the air. And so we have consideration of the idea of colonising New South Wales.
As opposed to Honduras or Gambia, you know, there are a few other places in contention.
Yes, but as I explain in the book, those places were in the old dispensation. They were places that would only replicate the earlier system of transportation across the Atlantic to the North American colonies. One of the real changes with Botany Bay was that the government itself became responsible for the convicts, for shipping them out and for employing their labour, and it also shifted the focus of transportation from the Atlantic world into the great world beyond the Atlantic. Now, these are quite extraordinary developments. They're not fly-by-night things. They had to be undertaken deliberately.
Well, there's one more historical furphy that you point your finger at. And that's the issue of the cost of transportation. We've always heard that it was inexpensive for the Brits. And while initially the cost of transporting one convict to New South Wales looked cheap, 34 quid per person per annum, compared to 28 quid to keep one convict on a hulk in the Thames,
as time went,
the revised figures puts the cost at 63 quid. Per convict per annum. It was starting to cost almost as much as dealing with these dreadful refugees.
That's right. And by the time all the costs for the first fleet came in, it had reached about £100 per person. I explain this in more detail in the second volume, or the accompanying book, which is called The First Fleet, The Real Story. The decision to colonise New South Wales involved the government in a very considerable financial commitment. And again, I don't believe that was undertaken, as is the phrase was commonly used, in a fit of absence of mind. Even incompetent governments have to think about money and what they're going to get back in return for the money they spend.
Your book's also interesting in that you point out that during the Seven-Year War, 1776 to 83, Britain was experiencing severe shortages of naval material, timber for masts, cables, cordage, canvas. So every quid was problematic.
That's true. And there's a larger and less tangible consideration, which is, in a way, it didn't matter how much these things cost. If you didn't have great masts for ships, if you didn't have flax and hemp for canvas and cordage, you couldn't operate ships. Now, obviously, this situation becomes absolutely crucial in wartime, but it still has a peacetime application. And one of the things I show in this book is that in August of 1786, at the very moment when the Pitt administration decides to colonise New South Wales, there is a real threat to the nation's supply of hemp from Russia.
And that's why there was a consideration of a new treaty with Russia that year.
Yes.
And where and how could this help? And where could we produce this material?
Well, that was a very good question. There was some attempt after 1786, the attempt to get flax, to get timber out of the Canadian provinces and also to get Canadian farmers to grow hemp. Neither of these things worked out very well. There were some good mass timber in India, but they had one of the problems is logistics. That the more the demand was for these naval materials, the harder it was to get at them, particularly if the timber were in the hills where there were no roads and no access with water. So that, given that it was relatively easy to cut trees on Norfolk Island or in New Zealand, because they grew down to the waterside, then the idea was that these materials could be taken to India, where in each war, particularly with the French, there was the British squadrons were consistently short of naval materials.
Factor India into this, because it was the main producer of cotton.
Sir Joseph Banks was involved in the Botany Bay scheme. He was also involved at the same time in sending the ship out to the Pacific to get breadfruit, which became the Bounty Voyage. But behind obtaining the breadfruit for the slaves in the West Indies so that they could work harder and grow more cotton, which could be manufactured, there was this idea that Britain could, with its beginnings of the Industrial Revolution, Britain could sell vast amounts of cotton cloth to China and Korea and Japan. And the great problem that the British had with trading with China in the 18th century was the Chinese took very little except silver bullion in return for their silk and tea and other porcelain and other commodities. If the British could find another item that the Chinese would trade, then they would have cargoes in their ships going out. They wouldn't have to obtain so much silver bullion, which could be very expensive, and in times of war was just about unobtainable.
Look, what you're talking about, what you're describing, makes us realise that globalisation is not the recent invention that we think it was.
In 2003, I published a book called The Global Reach of Empire.
Yeah. But, gosh, the interlocking interests, the sort of the jigsaw complexity of what you're describing, the administrative and bureaucratic problems of keeping the empire ticking over. Formidable.
Well, this is another point to make, and I think it's a very important point, which is that one of the things historians have established very well about Britain in the mid-19th century was this spread of bureaucracy and the way in which bureaucracy started to reach into many more aspects of everyday life than it ever had before. I think we should see the onset of this movement in the 18th century at, let me term it, that the state takes more and more control over circumstances. It seems to start, so far as I'm aware of it, with reforms to customs and excise duties in England at the beginning of the 18th century. And then as the British Empire expands, the Admiralty has to know not only where its ships are in North America or the West Indies or the Mediterranean or India, but it also has to know that it has materials, that its dockyards at Antigua or Port Mahon or wherever are equipped with items that the ships will need. This means keeping records.
So and they're doing this without the advantage, Alan Frost, of the sort of miraculously all-at-once communications that we have now.
Oh, that's true.
They're doing it at a time when it took months to get a letter.
That's true. And if you were to go to the Public Record Office and start working through the papers of the Navy Board, you would be astounded at the volume of papers. It's also astounding that people could produce these things writing by hand.
In your view, were these documents honest and candid? Because one of the things that one finds, even in a modern corporation, is the reporting upwards is often deeply flawed by people seeking personal advantage.
Well, that's another thing that's been said about the undersecretaries in the government departments at the time, that they were venal and they were corrupt. My view is that numbers of them, I wouldn't say, of course, that there was never corruption, but my view is that the most important ones involved in the Admiralty, the Navy Board, the Treasury, and the Home Office were actually very competent civil servants indeed. They worked enormously long hours. They wrote in vast amounts, and I think their performance is really impressive.
And the evidence of that, of course, is the British Empire grew in power and influence.
It did. And some people have made the point that in the late 18th century, of all the European maritime powers, only Britain had the wealth and the administrative capacity to undertake a venture like the Botany Bay Colony. And when you think about it, it's an enormous challenge to start a colony entirely from scratch in a place where there are no resources available. That is, there's no population that's producing food crops, for example, as there was in India when the British and the other Europeans got there. And not only that, but that voyage from Britain to New South Wales had been made only a couple of times before. And so this first fleet takes 750-odd convicts, 240-odd Marines and various other people, really into the unknown. It's an
in some ways, it's like sort of a Martian landing, isn't it? Trying to, you know, to form a human settlement on a neighbouring planet. However, going back to this idea of bureaucratic skill, I remember on previous programs over the years being told by historians that in a way they almost stuffed it up by not having the right sort of equipment on those early voyages, by not bringing enough ploughs, by not having appropriate seed stock and so on.
I don't believe that's true, though I certainly agree that there were severe difficulties in the colony in the first years. But Sir Joseph Banks equipped the First Fleet with an enormous number of plants and seeds. The problem was what you were talking about to Professor Lowe earlier. There was a long drought in Sydney between the end of 1788 and 1791, which was El Nino effect, we can now recognise. And how long does it take to learn about the environment? How many years do you think you have to work through the environment and keep records so that you know about events? Again, as Ian Lowe said, we don't know. We don't have the records to know how frequent an event may be or how infrequent it may be.
No, absolutely right. In fact, farmers in Australia in the last century only had a tiny bit of knowledge about weather patterns, and they didn't think to actually ask the Indigenous people what they might have known.
No, that's right. But you see, again, Philip, the question arises, we make judgments because we know what happened in the past. That's a different matter from thinking that the people who sent the First Fleet and the early colonists, and more broadly, didn't do it well because things didn't turn out well.
What you're describing is a British Empire which can be seen as a mighty multinational corporation, and for a long time doing pretty well.
That's right, I think. I don't wish to make it seem like the best of all possible worlds, but there are some extraordinary achievements, I think, in this, which haven't received due recognition from historians.
Well, you're trying to correct the record, aren't you, Alan?
I am, yes.
You're doing your best. Well, look, thank you very much for your time. Alan Frost's book, Botany Bay, The Real Story, published now by Black Ink. And the previous book was, would you give me the title of that again?
The previous book was The Global Reach of Empire, which was published in 2003. But the more importantly, I think, the second book that will appear in June from Black Ink is about the mounting of the First Fleet, and it's called The First Fleet, The Real Story.
That's the one I was after. Alan, thank you very much. Alan Frost, Emeritus Professor of History at La Trobe and the author of Botany Bay, The Real Story. Now, on our next, we will welcome back my friend Shapiro Bruce to preview Obama's State of the Union address at an absolutely crucial time. As you've seen, Obama has jumped back a bit in the polls, but he's a long way from being triumphant and still has to persuade many of his erstwhile supporters that he's up to the job. And you'll meet a bloke who's an expert on Eastern Europe who will present the mass murders of Stalin and Hitler as two aspects of the same story, by taking in the countries to the east, in which 14 million people died. Now, what I want you to do is now to listen to our new theme, pretty much as in its entirety, and, of course, at the end of it, you'll hear the news on Radio National.